Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're starting the show today by talking about the health of your digestive system with our guest, Dr. Siegfried Yu. He's a gastroenterologist with Amplify Health in La Crosse. And as we talk with him, I want to hear from you. What would you like to know about the way your digestive system works, maybe? Wondering how to get rid of constipation or maybe diarrhea is an issue. There are all kinds of things we can talk about with him today. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or maybe your own experiences. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dr. Siegfried Yu, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you, Larry. Love your show.
Thank you so much. You know, the digestive system, and I guess it includes several organs that turn food into energy. What are the most common digestive problems patients come to you with?
I would say definitely among them include constipation, acid reflux, irritable bowel syndrome, and related problems. And of course, on the other end of things, screening for colon cancer is extremely important. So
all things we can definitely talk about today. I'm sure there is a medical definition of constipation. What is that definition?
Generally, it's a perception of decreased bowel movement frequency and or difficulty evacuating stool. So that might mean different things for different people. Commonly, someone, you know, may have a normal bowel movement every day, but if they're having trouble evacuating, they may still be constipated. On the other hand, someone could have multiple bowel movements a day and might even have loose stool, but could have a problem emptying that can get a little bit more confusing. So it's not as straightforward as you would imagine. But generally, if someone has skipped 2-3 days of time without having a bowel movement, you know, and has trouble emptying, that's enough to classify them as having constipation symptoms.
I'll admit that sometimes when I go off on vacation or somewhere else, I might have that issue for a couple of days, and then it sort of rights itself. Is that one of the let me put it this way. What are the most common causes of constipation?
No, as you pointed out, a lot of those lifestyle factors can contribute. And using the example you cited, changes in setting like travel, you may not drink as much. You might not, depending on how you're getting to where you're going, you might not be moving around as usual. And as everyone knows, something that happens with travel and vacation, our diets change. So fiber intake can be something that we might not get as much of with vacation eating habits, among other reasons.
Yeah, so you're saying diet and hydration play a pretty big role.
Sometimes more than we realize it, and in many ways the standard American diet has become very fiber deficient. So apart from adequate water intake, you know, making sure that someone's dietary intake of fiber is, you know, kind of the next important thing as it relates to normal bowel habit.
So that would, I'm wondering on the remedy side, if you've got mild constipation, a simple at-home remedy?
You know, it all depends on, to some degree, the severity. In a situation like yours, that might correct pretty easily just by correcting the water issue. Mm-hmm. The problem is the longer one goes without having a normal bowel movement, the more difficult it can become to sort of correct those symptoms. And a useful analogy I commonly use when I see my patients in the clinic or in the hospital is the plumbing analogy. So the job of the digestive tract is in many ways to process the food we eat. Part of the role of the colon is to reclaim a lot of that water and remove the food residue that we have not utilized for nutrition purposes, and it forms stool. And of course, the job of the colon and, you know, that lower area of the body that we sometimes refer to as the pelvic floor is to remove that material. So when that clog forms, the longer it forms and the more chronic it becomes, the more difficult it is to unclog, so to speak. So if, depending on how symptomatic someone is, they might need some extra help with over-the-counter remedies if the simple things like water and fiber and activity have not fixed it.
So you, and I guess we're talking about laxatives here.
Mm-hmm.
So do you recommend using laxatives at home, maybe without advice from a doctor?
I would say not on a regular basis. And if anything, particularly depending on what someone's demographic is, say they're in an age range that is more appropriate for colon cancer screening interventions or strategies, and they've never had that done and they start to notice new problems with their bowel habit, you know, that might be more of an indication that they might need more evaluation and not put that kind of medical assessment off, you know, because although we hope it's never something more serious, sometimes those symptoms might represent something besides an innocent episode of constipation triggered by a lifestyle.
Yeah.
Of some kind.
You know, and those tests are, I mean, all right, they're a little bit of a pain to take the liquid and so forth. But they're, I've always found them to be pretty straightforward and pretty easy, colonoscopy screening.
And I would say for the majority of people, that's the case. Not everyone will tolerate them the same way. And, you know, of course, there's the psychological aversion just to testing in that area that's understandable for many, or they hear about you know, a bad experience someone may have had. But I would say more now than ever, we have the ability to make it a very comfortable experience for the majority of people. And even if it's not something one wants to jump into as far as, the colonoscopy itself, there are some tests that are available that are very good to use for screening purposes. That could be, you know, maybe a next best step, like stool testing, among others.
Yeah.
And I would say the although they're not easy to collect, it's better than not doing anything at all. And keeping in mind that an abnormal test will almost certainly result in a recommendation to get the formal test done.
Yeah.
So.
What are some, let's talk about food here a little bit too. High fiber foods, what are some of the best ones that can help with constipation?
You know, I would say generally the advice I give would be the more natural foods that one might consider part of what commonly, at least these days, may be described as a kind of a whole food approach. To a plant-based dietary strategies or plant-focused dietary strategies. So your fresh fruits and vegetables, whole grains are definitely going to be on that list. Minimizing ultra-processed food is key, I think, in general, as a principle, at least in modern society, as far as healthy choices, because they are everywhere and they're generally not going to be as healthy. So the more natural and less processed something is in general, as long as someone tolerates it, that's a good thing, of course, with adequate hydration, water intake. And, you know, on the other hand, some people might opt for fiber supplements, which are also somewhat ubiquitous.
Yes.
You know,
yes, they so are.
maybe less desirable, but you know, perhaps better than nothing as a place to start if someone does tend to have a diet, say that's higher in red meat and in Wisconsin cheese curds, and you know, things of that nature. They might not get very much fiber, apart from maybe a potato or something. But you know, for people that might have a dietary pattern like that, I'd say it's reasonable to use a supplemented fiber while they're trying to bridge the gap. And as far as adjusting some of the healthier whole plant-based dietary choices.
Yeah. I was thinking about myself. I'm sure I eat more fruits than I eat vegetables, partly because I bring a lunch to work, and I always have an apple, and I always usually have a couple of nectarines, maybe, or an orange, or cuties, as they call them. So I'm having that pretty much 5 days a week.
That's good.
Well, what about exercise? Does exercise play a role?
I would say it definitely does, and depending on one's baseline level of activity is, you know, that may or may not be something they need to adjust a whole lot. However, you know, just like the dietary patterns that have changed over time in our modern society, our health habits like exercise and activity has also become at risk. So what we commonly describe as the kind of sedentary lifestyle where we may not be moving a lot or exercising. Thankfully, we live in an area where there are a lot of trails, and I think in general people embrace the outdoors even in cold weather,
yeah,
which is, I think, a good thing in our region in Wisconsin. But I would say a place to start would, for those who might not be as active, and you know, we have to account for people that might have other health issues related to mobility.
Sure.
You know, that type of thing. At least walking, you know, perhaps 30 minutes a day, if one isn't getting much activity of other kinds, is a good place to start. So.
Alfred in Cottage Grove has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Alfred.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Products like Metamucil and Miralax, are they considered laxatives? And what about using them on a daily alternating basis? Is there a problem there?
That's a good question, Alfred. And both of the products you cited are very common. You can find them in almost any grocery store, pharmacy, convenience store. Miralax, which is a kind of a proprietary name for the compound polyethylene glycol, not to be confused with windshield washer fluid. Sometimes we get that question. It is what we describe, at least in medical jargon, an osmotic laxative. So it is a laxative in the sense. And when we say osmotic, basically it works in the body by passing through the body in the intestine tract in particular and not getting absorbed. So it holds the water that it's mixed with in a way that allows that same fluid that you've taken in to pass to the colon with the intention of making the stools softer and increasing their movement out of your body. Metamucil, on the other hand, while fiber, when we look at it, might in some literature get lumped in among the options for treating constipation, much in the way a laxative might be classified. Metamucil is actually, interestingly, goes by the chemical name psyllium husk, which is derived from corn husk, believe it or not. And so this is a fiber supplement that's, again, meant to some extent, bulk as well as pass through in a somewhat similar way. And then that might be helpful for people that might not get as much dietary fiber. And sometimes we may use it in medical settings to help with people that have altered stool consistency. So say someone has a looser stool consistency, it might not be uncommon for their medical provider to also use something like psyllium just to kind of give a little bit of bulk. But the idea is that moving that material through, although their mechanisms, their ways of working in the body are different, they are commonly used either one or the other, sometimes in combination, to help correct some abnormal bowel habit. And as far as whether or not they're safe to use in the long term, you know, I think that depends on a variety of things. And I mentioned one of them earlier, talking with Larry. You know, for example, if someone might have a new symptom that hasn't been investigated yet, or they're appropriate for colon cancer screening and that hasn't happened yet, we probably don't want to self-treat very long without getting those things addressed. And, you know, the hope is that it results in a study that's very reassuring. But that's one reason why a lot of the self-treatments with over-the-counter products might not always be a good idea. And that's also why a lot of these products that are available over-the-counter are labeled in such a way that, you know, they are discouraging people using them past a certain period of time, because the companies know that there might be other things that need to be evaluated. So it's not necessarily that you can't use some of these products for, say, more than 2 weeks or longer, but because the people selling them don't know that you, as a customer, don't have something that needs to be further evaluated, they kind of have to hedge and make some of those statements.
Makes sense.
You know, on their labeling.
Yeah, makes sense. Alfred, thank you for calling. Dr. Siegfried, you are our guest today, gastroenterologist with Amplify Health in La Crosse. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We are talking about digestive health today on the program with our guest, Dr. Siegfried Yu, gastroenterologist with Amplify Health in La Crosse. And you can join in 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Kristen in Kenosha next. Hi, Kristen.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, my son, he's 19 at this point. But for probably the last 6 or 7 years, he's had some poop problems.
Constipation problems, is it?
That is. He doesn't poop for 3 or 4 or 5 days. And then when he does, it winds up coming out as an extremely hard, like, I don't know, Nerf football size poop. And he gets a couple of them, and I'm very, very concerned that he's going to have his intestines or bowels or whatever get destroyed.
Yeah, that's interesting. Dr. Yu, what do you think?
You know, it sounds like he has a lot of symptoms, and I would say first and foremost, because we're not in exactly a medical setting, I would want him to make sure to see his healthcare provider and get that more specifically evaluated, and perhaps, you know, a consult with someone like me on the other side of the state might be useful. But having said that, in general, these types of problems, although we generally think about them as affecting people, say, in their 50s, 60s or later, I've seen many, many young people that I've had to help and treat, you know, suffer from them also. And that's where that medical evaluation becomes important, because we don't always want to assume that, you know, it's just that problem. That's generally something that the healthcare provider that meets him would be able to make some initial assessment on based on the history. But clearly, when it's causing this degree of dysfunction and it's bothersome, even if it doesn't end up being something more serious, I think your concerns are correct in that if it goes on like this and does not get addressed, even if we're not talking something more serious, like a specific diagnosis that could be in the realm of cancer or inflammatory bowel disease or something, you know, more unusual than that, the mechanical consequences and the quality of life consequences are real. And, you know, even if it ends up being a type of situation where we might give someone an impression of irritable bowel syndrome with constipation based on a combination of the symptoms they're struggling with and their primary bowel pattern, that in itself can be a big reason for people to miss work, not be able to excel in school or at their job. So the life lost in the form of quality is a problem also, and we don't always look at it that way. But particularly, I would say, for a young person still in that early stage of life, but really for anyone who wants to have a full life, these types of bowel issues are treatable. That's only the type of thing that can happen when you kind of seek help. And sometimes they can become more complicated, and not all providers may be as comfortable or as adept at figuring these problems out and getting someone to a point where, you know, they're better. Sometimes it could require more specialized testing. But, you know, in even a young person who has a lot of problems, at least some initial evaluation and testing could be appropriate. And I would say that captures a little bit about what we might review. And certainly family history is important. So in some families, especially in recent times, things like onset of colon cancer at younger ages, although 19 is a little extreme, but people say in their 30s, where we wouldn't even start thinking about it for a decade to screen this person. Sometimes we, sadly enough, may see younger people diagnosed earlier with, you know, even late stage cancers. So again, that kind of emphasizes the importance of making sure we're protecting our health and having those things looked at, particularly if we're in those groups based on our age demographic and other things, or just based on unexplained symptoms, you know, on a case-by-case basis. Those types of tests are there to clarify and guide, you know, what needs to be done to help them.
So probably a visit to the regular physician, but maybe with a referral to a gastroenterologist?
That's commonly where that would start, assuming that things just don't get better with some of the simple things we talked about earlier, like adequate fiber, water intake, activity. Part of the problem is just like any problem, you know, there are certain forms of, say, mild constipation that are relatively easy to correct. Some people might have more more severe issues. And in their extreme form, what they could sometimes result in, you know, might end up becoming surgical in nature, just because of the consequences on the gut. But I commonly would associate an uncorrected problem like constipation with other things that might be maybe easier for people to identify with, like symptomatic hemorrhoids, abdominal wall hernias, hiatal hernias, diverticulosis, things of that nature. I commonly see happen to people that have uncorrected bowel problems, even if we're not talking about a serious diagnosis like cancer or inflammatory bowel disease, for example.
Kristen, I hope that helps. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. And Dr. Yu, you mentioned irritable bowel disease. I mean, basically, what is it?
And I commonly will see that term, but generally, at least in my specialty, we will commonly use the term irritable bowel syndrome as opposed to disease. Okay. At least in our literature, that's kind of the way you describe it. And, you know, part of it is that especially when we use the term syndrome, we're describing, in this case, a combination of things like what are the symptoms and how does that help us classify what's going on. And in a similar vein, you know, with constipation being common, affecting up to, say, 15% of the population, and the 2024 statistics for the U.S., you know, we're 342 million people strong. Take 15% of that group, you know, may very well have constipation, and maybe more, depending on who is, you know, not diagnosed. And as far as irritable bowel syndrome, the statistics are very similar, so it's a large group of people affected. Generally, there will be some component of abdominal discomfort or abdominal pain and abnormal bowel habit. And, of course, among the bowel habits, we've talked a lot about constipation. That's one of them. And the other one would be diarrhea. But, you know, sometimes people with this type of problem, assuming there's not another explanation, may have mixed symptoms. So they could have alternating constipation and diarrhea, which sounds a little funny, but it's maybe more common than you would think. So, yeah.
Oh, all right. We had an email from just have a first initial E. Is 28, has IBS, combination type, was diagnosed at the age of 20, frequently very gassy and bloated to the point where it's painful and their pants don't fit. He occasionally takes simethicone, and it helps, but worries, are there negative health impacts to frequent use of this drug, simethicone?
Simethicone, I would say, I wouldn't be so much concerned as far as it causing long-term problems. And simethicone, for those that aren't as familiar with, it's a common over-the-counter medication. It's actually the chemical name of things that you might find labeled as Gas X or, you know, similarly telling names. But I would be probably more concerned about, as I mentioned earlier, about it not actually correcting the problem itself. And, you know, what that is actually causing in the form of lost quality of life, lost productivity, among other issues that I've, you know, reviewed a little bit here. So one thing I commonly see in my gastroenterology clinic is that occasionally when someone is given the label of irritable bowel syndrome of whatever type, you know, many people are given the impression that that's just what it is and there's nothing we can do about it. Although I tend to differ in that, you know, I do think there's commonly something underlying this that is probably something that is correctable. And until that's sort of looked at, it might be a premature conclusion to make that someone is sort of resigned to living this way for the rest of their life. And there is a role for being seen in a more specialized setting. And even within my own specialty, not all gastroenterologists might be as comfortable pursuing the more specific testing for people with functional bowel disorders in the realm of IBS. But there are occasionally more specific tests that can help us measure, say, how slow is the colon actually, or how dysfunctional is the pelvic floor at emptying, you know, among other things that you might run into.
Yeah. Let's take another call. Gianni in Montello will give you a chance. Hi, Gianni.
Yes. Good morning, Larry, and the good doctor. What a great topic. Listen, unfortunately, and I have to emphasize the qualifier, unfortunately, I took care of my parents for 16 years, and they were bedridden and wheelchair-ridden, and I had to make the transfers. And I found, yes, constipation to be a growing problem during their inactivity. So my solution was prune juice. Prunes per se, boiled prunes, and then corn. And if that didn't work on occasions, we would go to turmeric, however it's pronounced.
Turmeric, yeah.
And that, because it is not particularly water soluble, that would, you know, open up the bowels, and it actually caused loose bowels. So 500 milligrams after about 8 to 12 hours would bring about a bowel movement.
Hmm. Comment on that, Dr. Yu.
You know, that's interesting. It's not something we utilize a lot for that reason, but turmeric, which for people who aren't aware, it's the substance that you might find in a lot of the cuisine, South Asian cuisine, that we might describe as curry dishes. Mm-hmm. It's kind of gained popularity as an anti-inflammatory, and there are studies about it. Whether or not I would actually use it as a go-to for people that have some problems is... So not something I've explored a whole lot. So that's interesting to hear that. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with using some of these more simple remedies if they do work. And, you know, one thing common to prunes and, you know, and the prune juice, of course, is the fructose content tends to be high. We tend to not absorb fructose as well because of the way it's in – absorbed in our small intestines, and of course the fiber component of the prune fruit, you know, is helpful. But a lot of people who are either immobile or totally bedridden and in the extreme would be, say, the person with a quadriplegia from a spinal cord injury that might be really, you know, in that position all day long. It can be very, very difficult to assist them with normal bowel habit. And it becomes a real priority also because of the consequences of them not emptying. So I'm glad that you're able to get a good response with those remedies. And I applaud you for being there for your parents.
Absolutely. Gianni, thank you so much for calling. And let's take a call from Molly in Madison. Hi, Molly.
Good morning, Larry. Good morning, doctor. I actually have a colonoscopy on the calendar for next week. And I was just curious if the doctor could talk through any common mistakes people might make in their preparation. Obviously, we get instructions and try to follow them, but I'm just curious if there's common errors that people make.
Hmm.
You know, I would say one of the the probably biggest mistakes one might make is how they're eating in the day before the colonoscopy. And when you think about what we're doing when we're trying to examine the colon as an organ, we need to be able to see the lining and detect things, sometimes small things, well, in a way that can protect you from cancer forming there later on. So the harder it is for us to see, the more difficult that task becomes. And because we're dealing with the colon, again, as an organ, whose job it is to form stool, the more residue that is left in the colon, the more difficult that job becomes, if it's possible at all. And so if someone, say, has a regular meal by accident that day before the colonoscopy, although there are some studies suggest you could perhaps have a breakfast and then go through your preparation, I would say we don't always know how everyone's bowel is going to respond. So, you know, somewhat non-apologetically, it's not uncommon for GI labs or procedure units to give standard instructions for everyone to increase the likelihood that everyone will be cleaned out well and get a good study in that regard. So that mistake of accidentally eating things that contain fibrous material, you know, is one of those mistakes that can be innocently made, especially when you're hungry are not used to fasting. But it's definitely important the day before, and depending on how difficult someone is to clean out, and sometimes you'll only know that after you've had one. Because it's not always obvious to a person that they might have a sluggish colon emptying function, one way they might realize it is if the day before their procedure, they notice they take, you know, usually we split the prep these days to make it easier on people and to get kind of a double wave effect. So they'll take the initial dose of the prep fluid that they've mixed, and they notice they have not had a bowel movement response. And sometimes it might even be later in the day before anything ever comes out. That's a sign that you might need a little more work to get empty. And, you know, you might even want to call the unit if they have an on-call person to let them know, I'm not sure I'm going to be prepared. Another issue is if someone vomits the prep. So not only is it not getting a response, but what's supposed to induce the response is out of the body once it gets vomited. That would be another thing to watch out for. But if it goes well, and I hope it goes very well for you, you know, what you should start to see is that the material coming out in the toilet should look as clear as urine or Mountain Dew might look like. You know, so that is a pretty good indicator that someone will be ready. It's not 100%, but it's far better than seeing a lot of residue, certainly, or a lot of cloudy fluid that's hard to see through. You just kind of have to imagine us trying to look through that fluid,
yeah,
finding things like precancerous polyps and that type of thing. And it might help to reduce the fiber intake even for a few days before the procedure. Or if you're a little constipated at baseline, taking Miralax maybe in the week before the test, just to make sure that you're a little more emptied before you start trying to clean it all out. And an analogy I commonly use, it's like cleaning one's house before they sell it. It's a lot easier for the person who's already got a spick and span house to get ready for the sale than it is for the someone who's hoarded a lot of material that's, you know, overflowing. It's not going to be so easy. And certainly with bowel function, I'm sure none of this is intentional. It's just what our bodies might be accustomed to, and until it really becomes important. Sometimes we don't realize that those types of things are an issue.
Molly, good luck. I very much appreciate your call and appreciate you listening in today. Thank you for listening in as we visit with Dr. Siegfried Yu. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News as we talk about your digestive health with Dr. Siegfried Yu, gastroenterologist with Amplify Health in La Crosse. Let's take a call from Penelope in Madison next. Hi, Penelope.
Hi. So my question, I'm kind of piggybacking off the last person, Molly, who was asking about the colonoscopy.
Sure.
So I sort of struggle with hemorrhoids and have since I had had my daughter some 35 years ago, on and off. This isn't anything that is sort of, you know, life-threatening or anything. But my question is, my diet's great. Why am I struggling with this?
Hemorrhoids, Dr. Yu.
That's a good question. And I did mention it earlier briefly, that term pelvic floor dysfunction. And while certainly hemorrhoids definitely can flare during childbearing for women, you know, because of the changes in pressure and, of course, you know, the delivery and everything related to that that can damage the pelvic floor. Part of why, apart from that initial event, the hemorrhoids may become an ongoing issue is that some of the mechanism for that emptying function of the pelvic floor changes. And, you know, childbearing is one example, but other reasons for change in pelvic floor function could include back injuries, other abdominal or pelvic surgeries, among others. And one of the reasons for hemorrhoids to kind of flare or persist is related to that dysfunction or uncoordination of that floor. And if you kind of imagine that, you know, that when we say, when we use the term straining, part of what's happening is that when people strain, they're attempting to have a bowel movement and usually they're pushing. But what many might not realize is when we are pushing in such a way that's putting a lot of pressure to empty the pelvic floor, but that muscle that controls the opening of the floor, in this case, the anal sphincter, if it's not opening or relaxing well when it should, all that pressure that's being placed on that area has to go somewhere. And one of the places are the hemorrhoids. And I commonly tell my patients, you know, who ask me, like, oh, I didn't have hemorrhoids before. Why did I get this? And the term gets thrown around somewhat loosely, so sometimes I have to ask myself, what do they mean by that? Because, in fact, in normal human anatomy, the hemorrhoid plexus is the normal blood supply to the anal sphincter region. So we all are, technically, if we're human beings with normal anatomy, we all have them, but the opportunity for them to become symptomatic is usually kind of the issue. So occasionally, if they become severe enough and there's not something else that can be corrected, and, you know, I mentioned pelvic floor dysfunction because I'm a gastroenterologist that deals with some of those problems, and it can be tested for and rehabilitated sometimes without needing any medication. You just need a good pelvic floor physical therapist who's trained to do that, and there's some preliminary testing. But assuming those things are corrected, there's no obvious constipation issue, the pelvic floor issue is explored and addressed. Sometimes the hemorrhoids just have gotten to a point that seeing someone like a colorectal surgeon, at least in our system, we commonly refer patients with ongoing symptoms from hemorrhoids to them. And it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to take them out surgically. There are things that can be done even in a clinic setting where they can put these kind of medical-grade rubber bands on the internal hemorrhoids to reduce the degrees of prolapse or symptoms from them that can be considered. So hopefully that helps a little bit.
Penelope, thank you. And to go along with that, we had another email about what are exercises to strengthen your pelvic floor. And I would imagine your recommendation of seeing someone skilled in that area.
I would echo that. I think you're right. And one of the more confusing points when it comes to pelvic floor function, and I talk about this to my patients all the time, is most people are familiar with this type of exercise called Kegels exercises. Or Kegels, depending on how you pronounce it. A lot of times that's helpful when people have trouble with incontinence of stool. And it seems intuitive that the stronger you make those muscles, the better it should be. However, as I just described with, you know, that type of more specific problem affecting the emptying of the colon in the region of the anorectal area, it requires proper coordination. And sometimes it's not that the muscles are not strong enough. Sometimes the problem is that they're not cooperating. So if all we're doing is strengthening them, but our problem isn't actually weakness, we might actually not feel better. And, you know, in fact, we kind of need to be trained to allow it to relax at the proper time. And again, that is a more specific problem that probably needs, a little more specialized testing and or access to special types of pelvic floor physical therapists that are trained in that type of management. So.
And just to go along with that, Sue has wonders about an upper age for colonoscopy. She hasn't had any polyps for 15 years, and the one 15 years ago was small and benign. She's 71 with diverticulitis and worries about perforations with thinning intestinal walls. And in the last minute here.
Sure. And, you know, those concerns are valid. Based on our at least the gastroenterology guidelines, up to 75, and it's starting at age 45, we consider that group of people appropriate for screening. There are some varying guidelines with different societies, but particularly if you've had a history of precancerous polyps, as well as something like diverticulosis. And, you know, to clarify, when we use the term diverticulitis, that's an infected diverticulosis pocket. When we say diverticulosis, it's just the presence of those pockets in the colon or wherever. Kind of like having appendicitis is different from having an appendix. So to clarify that point, and it's not uncommon if someone gets a diverticulitis episode, we will recommend a colonoscopy just to be sure there's nothing else going on, like a big polyp that's clogged to the pocket or a tumor near that area. Although that's relatively uncommon, it could happen. And after age 85 in everyone, we generally stop standard screening and surveillance if we haven't already stopped. But depending how healthy one is, how motivated they are, if they're in that kind of 75 to 85-year-old demographic, you know, on a customized basis, we'll still consider it.
Dr. Yu, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. I hope we can get you back and talk more because we certainly didn't cover everything. Dr. Siegfried Yu, gastroenterologist with Amplify Health in La Crosse. Coming up, we're going to talk about how do you mend a broken heart. That next. I'm Larry Mueller.
Stop the rain from falling down. stop the sun from shining. What makes the
pretty fitting song from the Bee Gees, How Can You Mend a Broken Heart? Fitting because we're talking about heartbreak right now and how it can affect your emotional and your physical health. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Guy Winch. Back with us, he's a licensed psychologist and author. He's a member of the American Psychological Association. And as we talk with Guy, I hope you'll join in. Someone in your life who's struggling with loss of a romantic relationship, maybe loss of a pet. What questions do you have about helping get through this? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Guy Winch, welcome back. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Great to see you again, and thanks for having me.
How did you become interested in heartbreak?
Well, I'm a therapist, and I think there's not a therapist who doesn't come across heartbreak. And I was seeing so many times that my patients, the people I worked with, when they would get into relationships or when they would get heartbroken, they absolutely had no clue how to heal. They didn't know what was normative. They thought they were going crazy. And I realized they really needed tools for managing this. And it's one of those topics that, you know, we didn't hear a word about in graduate school. Like, no one teaches you as a therapist, here's the class about heartbreak. There isn't one. And so I just slowly over time started coming up with my own tools and techniques and approaches, and then that turned into a TED Talk and a book, etc.
Sometimes you hear a sad story about someone supposedly dying from heartbreak. Is that possible?
I don't think it's possible to die from heartbreak per se. I mean, there are certain conditions where there's a medical condition that can mimic a heart attack, which can be triggered by heartbreak. Those are quite rare. But heartbreak can sideline you entirely. It can make you entirely non-functional. And by the way, at any age, this is not something that, you know, sidelines the teens and the young adults, and we as older adults are immune to. At any age, I've worked with people of all ages who, when they became heartbroken, literally stopped to function, couldn't leave their beds, couldn't go to work. It's a terrible acute pain that people go through.
Is it in the brain? Is that what doing it? Or, I mean, probably in part at least, but are other parts of the body are affected?
Well, the brain is involved in everything that happens
sure.
with the body. But what's interesting is that when they do brain scans of people who are heartbroken, they find that very similar pathways in the brain and very similar systems get triggered, as are triggered when heroin addicts are withdrawing from heroin.
Oh.
It creates this kind of a desperation of needing that person and needing contact with them. And you see the same kind of desperation that you see with heroin addicts when they are withdrawing, except heroin addicts know that they're withdrawing from a drug, so their behavior is understood to them. Their level of desperation is very clear to them why they have it. Heartbroken people often find themselves behaving in such difficult and strange ways to them, unfamiliar ways to them, and they think, oh, I must be going crazy. This is completely not like me, because they don't understand what's actually happening in their brain to cause it.
And I bet there are different kinds of heartbreak. I mean, because I've been through a couple of different kinds myself. You know, there's the romantic one that I'm betting that a lot of us have gone through. And then there's the one I was kind of really almost heartbroken over the loss of a pet.
Yeah, and I actually, in my book, I included those two topics because they have one thing in common. They are forms of grief that can have a huge impact on the person, but they're disenfranchised. No one is going to work and saying, I need a week off because my cat died. It would not be a good career move. And no one is going to work and saying, I need 2 days off because my girlfriend dumped me. If you're getting divorced, that's legit. But if it's just a regular breakup, it's not. And yet the impact on us can be very severe, and the grief we go through can be very severe. Some people, all they have in their life is a cherished pet. That is their companion, their family member, the person that greets them at the end of the day. And when that pet dies, it is a terrible, terrible loss. And yet it's just not something that we think about enough and consider seriously enough when we should.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And society, I think, treats pain. If you break your arm, you know, your people treat you one way, but I'm not so sure that it's the other. With a broken heart, it's a different kind of circumstance.
Look, all emotional pain is invisible, and that makes it something you have to kind of take on faith. You know, it's people don't respond well to emotional pain. Many people don't because they don't know how to respond. They're not sure what to say. You know, somebody breaks their arm. I'm so sorry. But they also know that once the arm is in a cast, it's not hurting anymore. Heartbreak can linger, and grief like that can linger for hours and days and weeks. And so people don't have a clear idea of how best to respond, how to help the person beyond saying, like, so how you're doing, you know, but usually they're doing terribly.
Yeah. Reed in Eau Claire has a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Reed.
Hello. I wanted to share that what I've learned from heartbreak is that self-awareness has been incredibly important, where trying to focus on other activities means that oftentimes the grief can come out in interesting ways, whereas simply sitting down, writing down the thoughts and sharing out loud the grief can often provide a fertile soil for growth, where I appreciate the relationships in the future more rather than becoming sort of cynical.
Hmm. Reed, thanks for calling. Comment on that, Guy.
Okay, so Reed, great. Three things you mentioned there, each of is important. One, you said, you know, sometimes doing other things. So yes, distraction is useful, certainly at the beginning, because you want to get your mind off it. Otherwise, you're just thinking about it all the time. And then you spoke about journaling, writing about it, that oftentimes we process our thoughts and our feelings by writing things down, and it can help us reach conclusions. And, you know, usually in the initial throes of heartbreak, you're just trying to deal with the pain. But a little bit later on, yes, you should start trying to consider, what can I take away from this? What can I learn for my future relationships? And then you mentioned talking about it. And social and emotional support are also extremely important. Those are very important ingredients to help us move forward and get through the difficult, painful aftermath and the potential for growth that happens afterwards. So in that one comment there, you had three very, very useful approaches to healing from heartbreak.
Yeah, Reed, thank you very much for calling. And I would invite you to join in as well with your own thoughts. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org. Well, it sounded like he has made some good progress in this, but I'm wondering about mistakes. What are some of the mistakes that you can make when you're heartbroken that makes the pain last longer?
Okay, so the most common one, and this is, it's very difficult to not fall down this rabbit hole, but the most common one is to keep stalking the other person on social media, to keep looking through the memorabilia, whether they're photos or videos, to keep thinking about that person. Because the way we do that is we tend to do that in idealized ways. When we're heartbroken, we don't think of all the terrible times we've had together. We don't think about the really bad fight we had just the week before, or all the disappointments, all the compromises. We tend to think of the ideal moments. We fantasize about all those romantic times, and we look at the pictures of when we're happiest, which are highly curated. And all that does is it presents a skewed version of the loss to us, which makes it sound like a much bigger loss to our unconscious mind, and that amplifies the pain. So it's very natural to idealize the person who broke our heart in the aftermath of heartbreak. And what I recommend to people is that they make a list on their phone of all the ways the person wasn't great, all the things they didn't like about them, all the compromises they made, all the disappointing, unfortunate, bad times they had together. And when their mind takes them to these idealized, romanticized versions of, oh, but they were so great, take out your phone and balance out that perception. Don't vilify them, but just balance it out by reminding yourself, no, they weren't that great. They were okay, but there was a lot that wasn't okay. At least if you're grieving, grieve a more accurate recollection and rendition of the person and of the relationship.
You know, we've all heard it. You may have mentioned it. That time will heal a broken heart. How do you feel about that? Saying, well, you know, somebody, you're talking to somebody about it, and they say, well, time, you know, time's going to heal that.
You can wait for time. It can be a long road, and you can make a lot of mistakes along the way. But there are actual things that you can do to accelerate the healing. As your first guest said, Reed, to even learn from it, but healing emotional wounds in general is something I'm trying to teach people. Is an active process. It's not a passive one. It's not just waiting it out. There are things you need to do. Like if you have a cut on your arm, you don't just let it heal. If it's small, you do, but usually you want to put something on it. You want to cover it. You know, there are certain things you can do to accelerate physical healing, and there's many things you can do to accelerate emotional healing. You just have to be more proactive and knowledgeable and sophisticated about what you can do and what's useful to do. So in heartbreak, for example, what I'm suggesting there with the list of the bad stuff to balance it out, that will shorten the time that you are in pain. It will also shorten the time that you're in pain if you stop looking at their social media. People will spend hours looking at the person's social media, and it will hurt them tremendously when they do. Because what do we put on social media? Only the good stuff. You're not going to see your ex sitting at home missing you. They're not going to put that on social media. You'll see them out with friends. So while you're at home, you know, like crying into a bucket, and you're like, how can they be out with friends when I'm in so much pain? You know, like it's just going to make it hurt more. So the idea of no contact is actually really important, at least at the beginning. And you know, people say to me, well, can't we be friends? And I'm like, sure, but not now. You cannot be friends with someone who's just broke your heart, because their presence and their friendship is going to extend the heartbreak and make it hurt. Once you get over them, if you feel compelled to be their friend, do so. But most people, once they're over them, are like, I don't need to be their friend. Exactly. So don't. You know, you can't do friendship right away. You have to get over the person, and it requires distance.
Is that true as well with divorce? You get a broken heart over divorce?
It's true about divorce. It's more complicated with divorce. It's more complicated when you have children and you have to be in touch. It's more complicated when you work in the same workplace or when you live in the same neighborhood and you're actually going to see each other, because then it's difficult to get that distance. But you have to try and get it where you can. And you have to try and, you know, because again, the reminders are going to be very difficult. There's one other thing that happens that I want to explain to people that befuddles a lot of people, and I think it's critical that people understand. When someone decides to leave, certainly a marriage, but even a dating relationship, they often don't do it on a whim. They often, you know, it's a process of contemplation where they finally arrive at some point at the conclusion, no, I want to break up. I don't want to stay with the person. Great. That is not the moment in which they walk into the, you know, person while they're having breakfast and say, right, all right, decided I'm leaving. It's not how that works. People are much more thoughtful and strategic about when they're actually going to make the announcement and leave. And so they sometimes will sit on it for weeks and even months, because they actually, you know what, let's not do it right before the holidays, or let's not do it before their big presentation at work, or the kids are coming to visit, let's at least wait for that visit to be over. They'll be strategic about it. In the meantime, they are moving on and they are disconnecting emotionally, but they're faking it with a person because they don't want to let the cat out of the bag. They want to do it in the right time. But then when that time comes, they're already so far along in the process, they seem like, how have they gotten over me so quickly? Well, they've been thinking about it for months. You're new to this realization. They're not.
Dot in Chippewa Falls, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
I just want to share my idea on how to deal with people who have passed.
Okay.
Okay. I've done quite a bit of eulogies for many family members and friends, and it seems to help. I know it's hard for people to go up and do a eulogy, but once you get up there and speak in front of all those people, it's more likely somebody else is going to stand up and say something about the person that passed. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But I still have a hard time with, I still have a hard time with so many family and friends that went to heaven, but now if I don't do a eulogy, I just don't feel right.
Huh. Guy, comment.
Look, that's a very good point about grief in general, but you doing a eulogy is not something everybody has the opportunity to do in that public forum. But that doesn't mean you can't do one if that's helpful for you, that you can't do one privately. It can be some kind of ritual that you do in which you actually write something, write a eulogy about the person who you've lost, and you can go to their grave or you can go to some kind of site that's meaningful if you can't be at their gravesite, you know, in person, and you can read it to them in absentia, obviously, but you can write a eulogy and read it if that's a ritual that helps you move past grief. It's one you don't, you know, if you can do it publicly, terrific. But if you don't have the opportunity, you can still avail yourself of that tool, of that, you know, psychological tool, and do it privately. And it's going to be very impactful to do that.
Yeah, thank you very much. Sometimes people get over a relationship by starting a new one. How can you tell? You know, and that may not always be the best approach. How can you tell if you're really over the old one?
Look, I'm going to be a little crude, if I may. When people say to me, how do you know, how do I know if I'm ready to, you know, start dating again or even to, you know, have sex again? I say, look, if you can get through it without crying or vomiting, you might be ready. Because essentially, if you wait until you feel ready, you waited too long. Part of getting over is introducing the option and the idea that there are other people out there, that there might be another relationship for you. And it's very hard to know when you're exactly ready for that. So I say, err on the side of maybe too soon. You'll know if you're going to a date and you're sitting with someone and you cannot listen to a word they're saying. All you're thinking about is your ex and you're just not present at all. Okay, too soon. But if you can get through it, and if you can just, okay, let me just see if this person is interesting, even if I'm not emotionally available, even if I'm not really, you know, going to, you know, go for them at the moment, let me just have a conversation and remind myself what it's like to be on a date, or remind myself what it's like to ask someone out, or to go out and get to know someone, that can really help with the healing. And so I'm all for it. Like, if you're not sure, try. And if you can get through it, maybe do it slowly. But do it. If you're really not ready, you'll know, like, oh, no, I couldn't even think of it. But sometimes we're ready before we realize, and that's what I'm urging here.
Let's say you're friends with someone who's experiencing heartbreak. What's the best way to support them?
Look, they are in a lot of pain. And so the best way to support them is to, if you're not sure, by the way, this is true about heartbreak and about grief and about somebody who might be going through cancer or anything. I ask people, if it's a good friend, I say, hey, you're going through this. My tendency is to want to call you every day and say, how are you doing? I know that might be too much for you. What's the best way I can be there for you? What's the cadence of reaching out that would work for you? Should I check in daily right now? Do you want me to come over? What would be helpful? To have a talk, to take you out for a movie, to distract you? I literally will ask the person, what would you find most helpful? Most people will be able to tell you. But that question is showing concern, and it's showing a motivation to help the other person, and that alone is soothing. But make yourself available. Say, like, look, if you want to just talk about that, talk about the heartbreak and just go on and on about it, I'm here. I can be an ear for you. But if you're not sure, it's always good to ask.
And when's the time to seek professional help?
There's something called complicated grief. If it's been 6 months, in general, for grief, or a year, and you're really not moving forward, in other words, you're really feeling the same thing, you're stuck as you were a year ago. Not that you're better, but not quite better, but you're really not getting better. You've had this breakup, you're not dating, it's been you know, 6 months, a year, you know, you're still ruminating about the person, still regaling your friends with the same old quandary, like, why did they do this or this? Then maybe you need to seek professional help, because this is a process of healing. Should, in when it comes to emotions, should be similar to what we experience physically. In other words, you want to see a gradual easing of the pain. You want to see a gradual return to full functionality. You want to see an incline of getting better. And if you're on a plateau and staying there, you might need a little professional help.
You're an advocate for emotional health. What does it mean to be emotionally healthy?
It means the same thing as it does to be physically healthy. It means to be able to be aware of what our emotions are, to be able to process them, to be able to treat emotional wounds, and to have a certain sophistication of understanding of how we're feeling, of what we need to address our emotional needs. You know, sometimes I say to people, well, tell me what your emotional needs are, and they can't even really identify it. But do you need more contact, more connection? Do you need more support, more validation? Do you need, you know, like, again, there's an array of needs that we have. But we have to actually check in with ourselves and ask ourselves the question once in a while, which we're not used to doing. You know, when we have an ache or pain, we know it because it's an ache or pain. But we can say to ourselves, how am I feeling this week, this month, today? What's missing in my life? What do I wish I had more of in terms of my friendships, in terms of how I feel about myself and my self-esteem, my productivity, my efficacy in the world, my hopefulness? All of those things are things that we can address. And if we find lacking, to seek how to improve.
Well, this has been wonderful. I think our next guest is quite a bit of that in her new book. But your new book is coming out in February.
It is.
And I hope we can get you on to talk about the book when it comes out.
I would be delighted to come back.
Well, it's always a delight to have you, Guy. And I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. And we'll probably see you in February.
I hope so, and it's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Guy Winch, licensed psychologist. He's a member of the American Psychological Association, and his new book coming out in February is Mind Over Grind, How to Break Free When Work Hijacks Your Life. It'll be published by Simon & Schuster, and we'll talk about it. Coming up next, another book that we're going to deal with, relating to our Wisconsin state parks, but the title, Time, Beauty, and Grief, A Hike Through Wisconsin's 50 State Parks, and it's a lot more than that. That next. I'm Larry Mueller. My broken heart, and let me live again. Thank you very much for joining us today here on WPR News. Our next guest went on an epic quest, shall we say, to hike every single Wisconsin State Park. She achieved her goal, learned a lot about herself, I think, along the way, and now she has written a book to help you reflect on your life. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us. And our guest, Betsy Corbinier, is the award-winning author of the book Time, Beauty, and Grief, A Hike Through Wisconsin's 50 State Park. She uses her 30-plus years of social work experience to weave together a professional and personal story of aging and resilience. She grew up here in Wisconsin, above a cheese factory, if I'm not mistaken, and on a century-old farm. Betsy has hiked in multiple states and in several countries, and her book was recently honored, and I can see why, it was recently honored as one of the two books chosen to represent the state, our state, at the 2025 National Book Festival in Washington, D.C. So as we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. How do you approach getting older? Have you made a goal for yourself about maybe a milestone birthday tell us why you enjoy hiking in our state parks, perhaps. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Betsy, welcome
to the show. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, Time, Beauty, and Grief, a hike through Wisconsin's 50 state parks. It's a lot of things going on in your book.
There are. It's about the trails that I hiked. It's about doing a life review as at my 65th birthday, because I try to do those at milestone birthdays. After being a hospice social worker and doing those with many people in the last 6 months of their life, I realized that's not what I wanted to do. So I've done them for every milestone birthday. And they really help us process things that we want to let go of and reframe our regrets and find safe places for our traumas so that we can move forward and live a happier life as we get older.
Yeah, you're a very good writer.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
And I like the title. So you've got Time, Beauty, and Grief.
Yeah, I chose those words because they just sort of became part of almost every park I was in. I had lots of unusual time experiences, like at Rock Island State Park. There's a place you can stand inside the lighthouse where my friend that was hiking it with me was standing shoulder to shoulder with me, and my phone said one time on Central Time, and hers said Eastern Time. It's because it's right on the line. And
Diana, also, your friend.
Yes. And also, as you get older, time almost becomes like an entity that sort of accompanies you forward, because when you're younger, it rolls out endlessly before you. But as you get older and you realize that it's got a finite quality to it, it becomes much more substantial in your life to think about.
Yeah. I was thinking about the cruise ad that's on public television a lot, where the guy who owns the company talks about time.
Yeah, I know which ad you're talking about, yeah.
And I thought of that immediately when I was thinking about it, and I think he's right.
Yeah, absolutely.
In how he defines and talks about time.
Yeah.
Well, so this quest, where'd your idea come for this quest? Talk about that.
Well, when I turned 60, I went on a hike that I'd always wanted to go on since I heard about it as an eighth grader, and that was a coast-to-coast walk across England. It goes from the Irish Sea to the North Sea. And I wanted to do another big hike for my 65th birthday, but because I have a respiratory disability and it was kind of coming off COVID, I thought I needed to do something closer to home. And that's the thing with setting a quest and taking a challenge. You need to do that as you get older. You need to create novel experiences for yourself, but they also have to be within your risk tolerance level. You want to keep taking risks, which is really important, but you want to do them in a way that's maybe a little different than you did as you were younger.
Yeah, and that earlier hike was quite meaningful for you.
Yeah, it was really powerful to be able to do that. Because, again, that was a much bigger risk.
Yeah.
Traveling by myself and going on that 190-mile hike, yeah.
Yeah. So this quest, the 50-state park, well, I think it was originally had 45 in your head.
But yeah, I was thinking I have 45 because there is a total of 50, but there's five that are just kind of odd. They're sort of odd outliers. And so I plan to hike 5 miles in each one. And I finished the 45, and I thought, well, I'll just finish the last five, and, you know, after winter, and I'll be fine. And then I ended up with one of my hiking boots in the grave, and don't want to give away too much of that. But it really taught me a lot about how things can really change really quickly, and that you have to keep finding resilience in yourself. And I think that's, well, that's one of the reasons why I added beauty to the title, because that's where I find resilience, is in seeking beauty and being in beautiful places. So that really helped me a lot to recover so that I could finally finish the 5 miles in the last five state parks.
Well, I think in one of them, I think it was the Bigfoot Beach, which was really early on. You talk about all of the changes that happened in your life.
Yeah.
The previous, you know, the past 10 years.
Right, right. Just a lot of things, getting divorced and having an empty nest and losing my job and all those things, retiring, yeah.
So, and you made a lot of changes at that point. I mean, other than those that...
Yeah.
You know, you went to, let's see, you changed your name.
Yeah, changed my name, yeah. And then during COVID, I dyed my hair blue so I could fight against the invisibility of getting old. So
I kind of like that, the way you look at it, because you talk, you making changes. And it, one of the things that you talk about in the book, as we get older, is... the business of feeling kind of invisible.
Yeah, yeah. We're not given as much attention, especially as women, when we get older. And I think a lot of times, because there's so much ageism, that society discounts people as they get older. Like, they have a stereotypical view of what we are, and... So that's one of the things, the blue hair makes people have to think twice a little bit about it.
Well, you know, we should go back and explain to people sort of how your book's laid out, because there are some parts of it we haven't talked about yet, really.
Right. So each chapter is about a park, and so I include in there the trails I hiked and kind of what I was thinking about each day, and that could be anything from... to thinking about purging my stuff, which is one of the things you have to do as you get older, to grieving my parents, to thinking about how my body is changing and I have to adjust to that, and how am I going to keep doing what I want to do and stay healthy, and all those kind of things, all the different aspects that go along with getting older. And I talk a lot in the book about, because I was a social worker for 30 years, about the psychosocial stage that we're in when we get to be 65 and till the end of our lives, and that's of integrity versus despair. And so you have to look, as you look back on your lives, and if you've ever hung out with an elder, you know they like to tell stories, sometimes the same story over and over. And it's because we're processing our lives, and telling our stories is really important. And our lore is really important to keep sharing with younger people. And that helps us search for integrity, like, what things in my life did I do that made a difference in a positive way for the world, or even for just one other person? That's how we find integrity. And, you know, despair is still out there, because there's the despair of aging and the inevitable result of that. But it's really hard to hang on to those, that fear of death. It's much easier to concentrate about the joy of being alive. And that's that balance that you need to find so you can keep finding purpose and meaning in your life.
Our guest today, Betsy Corbinier, and her book is a dandy. It's titled Time, Beauty, and Grief, A Hike Through Wisconsin's 50 State Parks. Thoughts on maybe aging, thoughts on hiking, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today as we talk with the author of Time, Beauty, and Grief, A Hike Through Wisconsin's 50 State Parks. The author, Betsy Corbinier, and it's great to have her with me in the studio today to talk. And questions or comments or maybe an experience to share. I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. One part of the book I don't think you mentioned, and I'll tell you a little secret about it. It's the end of the chapter. You have questions for readers to complete their own life review. When I started reading the book, I just sort of skipped over those because I needed to read the entire book. And then I started paying a little closer attention to them. And then by the end of the book, I was thinking, even if you didn't read the book, if you took this particular questions, that, and there was always one really a thought-provoking question about your own life. Go ahead and talk about that.
Yeah, so I thought since I was doing a life review, it'd be good to sort of engage the reader in actually asking some of those questions of themselves, so that when they would go out on a hike, they could say, yeah, you know, do I have plans set for my own funeral? What kinds of things have I done to secure myself so that as I go forward, I will be able to keep doing as much as I can do? Those kind of questions that you have to think about, like, are there regrets in my life that I want to bring forward and try to reframe? Those kind of things. And I think one of the things that the questions have done is lend the book really well to be a book club book. There's a couple of book clubs in the state that are reading it right now because it's got those questions already embedded in it for book clubs to discuss then. So it makes it kind of a fun book for that.
Yeah, and I think it's it made me stop and think about certain parts of my own life that came out not only from reading the chapter, but it just caused me to think about where was my own life relating to this particular question or that one. So
yeah, like the park in Milwaukee, when I was talking about how can you be cool when you get to be a certain age?
I like that one.
That was some of the questions at the end were about how, you know, what do you find about yourself that makes you stay cool? You know, like where you feel like when you were younger and you thought you were really cool, that, you know, what part of being old is still a way to be considered cool? So that was a fun questions to ask.
The Peninsula State Park, when you were in Peninsula, and Peninsula happens to be my own favorite state park.
Oh, it's just beautiful. Yeah.
It's beautiful. And I think it might be my favorite one because I have the most positive experiences. There are so many family experiences and even individual experiences at that park. And I mean, I've been to 36 of the 50.
Oh, wonderful.
Parks over the years. So there are some that others would consider more beautiful or more fun or whatever, but I like that one not only for its beauty but also for its the memories that I have associated with it.
Yeah, yeah.
You have a similar one with Kohler Andrade State Park, which I think you said was your favorite
park.
Yeah,
that's my absolute favorite is Kohler Andre, and it's because of the memories that I've had there. But I have to tell you, every park is a jewel. Like when I hiked at Natural Bridge State Park, it was a 95-degree, 95% humidity kind of day. And I started out hiking so I would end up at the Natural Bridge so I could get my 5 miles in. And by the time I got to the Natural Bridge and was under that cool archway, oh, it felt so nice to be there. I can understand why humans lived there 11,000 years ago because it's very beautiful. And just like there's a place in Council Grounds State Park where you're right on the Wisconsin River and it's really shallow and the light just sparkles off the stones. I mean, there's just so many beautiful places to see.
When you were writing about Peninsula, it also, I mean, each time you're in a park, it causes you to think about or you write about a certain topic that came to mind.
Yeah.
And you did write about stereotyping in that park? What is it about stereotyping and aging?
I don't know. It's kind of that old dogs and new tricks kind of idea, yeah, that's just become this idiom that everyone believes, and it's really not something you want to internalize, because when you internalize those things, then you stop taking risks and you stop learning new things and having novel experiences. And those kind of risk-taking and taking chances on learning new things, like even like technology stuff, is really, really important for us to keep our brains going and keep our hearts happy as we get older. And a lot of times you'll see that kind of negative ageist stereotyping in how people speak to you. Like they use sing-song voices and call you honey and all those kind of things. And you want, it's sort of disempowering when people do that. So you want to maintain your power as an individual as you get older and not give up your agency.
And there are some other times you're flinty a little bit at times.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that I took from that is that friends may not stay with you forever, and that's something you have to kind of realize. And maybe you could talk about that whole business with friendships at long-time friendships when you get to be in a particular age.
Yeah, because what you want from your life and how you want to feel about yourself and what boundaries that you have about what you will and won't do change over your lifetime. And I think that as you get older, it's really important to become even more true to yourself than you ever were. Not to be sort of, well, I'll do this just to keep the peace kind of an idea. That you have to keep your internal peace and make that the most important thing. So sometimes that means letting go of people that have been in your life for a long time. And that's important for you to be able to do those things, because this is the last part of your life and you want it to be authentic for yourself.
Yeah, and when you're 65, okay, it's sort of the retirement age, but it sure as the heck doesn't have to be the end of your life.
Oh, no. Oh, no. And it's like, I'm not an elite hiker by any means. You know, I'm a slightly overweight old woman, and I get out there and I hike and I enjoy it. And like, I was just out on the Jurassic Coast of England in May, mm-hmm, hiking, and I was, you know, in the group, I was always like one of the last people getting to where we were supposed to go. But that doesn't matter. You know, what matters is you're out there doing it and just enjoying it and appreciating nature and being out in beauty.
Hey, there's nothing wrong with just stopping and looking around when you're on a hike. And you do tend to, you write very well about little things that you see along the way.
Yeah, it's important to experience where you are. And especially when I was hiking all the parks, I did it in about 13 months. I was hoping for 12, but it ended up to be 13. And I knew a lot of them I would not go back to again. So I really wanted to just slow down and experience them. And some of the parks, to get in the 5 miles, I had to walk, because they only had maybe 1 or 2 miles of trails, I would have to walk in one direction and then walk in the other direction. And it was kind of became an analogy of aging, too. Like sometimes you start off going somewhere and then you're like, nah, that's not going to work. I'm going to have to turn around and try a different thing. And hey, look what I found doing this, you know. So it was like at Rocky Arbor, I did that, hiked in one direction and then hiked back around the other direction. And when I went around the other direction, I found a big flowering of orchids that I hadn't seen the first time around. So you just find different magical things when you're out.
I kind of like going back and forth through something in the opposite direction, because I invariably find things on the return trip that,
yeah,
I wonder how I missed that the first time around.
I know, it's kind of fun.
Well, there are so many things. Marion Madison has something that she wants to bring up. So let's go there. Mary, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Thank you. What was your favorite animal encounter in the state parks?
Oh, I saw a porcupine at Whitefish Dunes, and that was very synchronistic because I had, was loving being there. It was such an amazing park. And I thought, I'm going to stay and hike like 8 miles here. And then I started thinking, oh, I better not. I got a really long drive home. So I ended up cutting it short and taking a different trail than I had planned on. And I walked right upon this little baby porcupine just sitting on right next to the trail. And so I stopped and just watched her for, gosh, 15, 20 minutes before she wandered back off into the forest. And if I hadn't come upon her right then, I would have never seen her. Because once she wandered into the grass, then she just disappeared.
Yeah, well, that's pretty cool. And that's one of the finds at a state park that you're not going to see very often. I've only seen porcupines a couple of times in my whole life.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, Mary. It was really wonderful.
So, you know, we're not covering everything here. There's so many things that you address. Living alone, since I'm someone who lives alone most of the time, again, you know, the kid will come home and that once in a while, but there are, you ruminate on many things about your life, but that are useful for anybody, and one of them was living alone.
Yeah, and just being, you have to always, it's again that integrity versus despair idea, like, am I okay with my aloneness, and then can I entertain myself and keep myself from boredom and keep myself from feeling sad and lonely? Or am I going to just let myself be lonely and not do things to make myself rise out of that? So that's always that balance that you have to find.
But you seem to have found that pretty well.
Yeah, I still struggle with it on occasion. But, you know, I think that for the most part, I keep myself pretty happy, so.
Well, I think you do, and you do like painting your nails and all the rest of it to make yourself stand out and
yeah, not to be so invisible. Yeah.
So and there are downsides, of course, to living alone, and you go through those as well, and you even talk about dating.
Yeah, talking about dating sometimes. Yeah, that's always a. It's hard when I talk to young people, it's hard for them. So, and I remember when I was younger, it was difficult. So it still remains difficult as an older person as well.
And I thought you had some good comments about, your own experiences where somebody you realized right away, and this came up in our segment just before yours about dating, where you realize right away this person is not ready to start a dating.
Yeah, and, you know, having been a therapist for so long, it's like, nah, I don't want to do it for free, you know.
Well, it's full of, your book is just full of comments and stories that are very well told. We get the pleasure of learning about every one of the state parks with some nice drawings.
Right.
And I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today, Betsy. It's been a real pleasure. The time flew by.
Well, thank you, Larry. And just so everyone knows, if you do go to a state park and you like it, please donate to the Friends of the Park. I pledge to donate 20% of the proceeds from my book to the Friends of Wisconsin State Parks. I've been able to give over $500 so far, so it's really wonderful.
It's been great talking with you, and I hope you get a chance to pick up a copy of Betsy's book. It's titled Time, Beauty, and Grief, A Hike Through Wisconsin's 50 State Parks. And it's not only about the parks, as you just learned in our conversation, but a lot of other things that are quite useful. They were to me, and they probably will be for you as well. Big thanks to Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins of our team, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks again for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.